of your local Christian radio station here in Southern Oregon and Northern California. Merry Christmas to you. Thanks for joining us here today on the Daily Connection. I'm Pat Daly, and it's just the best time of the year. Not only
it's the most wonderful time,
yes, but we get to hear Chris White sing, and so I know
you
were laying in wait for that one all day long. But Chris is here along with sidekick Matt, and you know, glad you could. We usually do this on Thursday.
We usually do,
but we decided that, well, for whatever, just it was tough. But we all had today together, and so. We're going to do it today.
We only have today, Pat.
We only have today.
We only have today. So,
and we got to fill that leisure time somehow. You know?
That's right. So,
okay. Well, anyway, I'm glad you could come in and talk about a topic that would, I think, it's just great because we haven't considered these guys.
That's right. We're talking today, of course, though, about the Christmas story. And you know, Pat, one of the things that.
No, wait. We're talking about the Holy Family, aren't we?
Well, we're talking in its totality. It is the Christmas
story. As a totemic representation?
As a totemic manifestation.
I'm on board.
Okay, I'll turn his mic off, Matt, and we'll just...
We're talking about the Christmas story. And, you know, when we're talking about that, we're not really talking about something from the annals of church history, but rather something that is from the pages of sacred scripture. And so when we talk about something like this, we are, of course, touching on holy ground.
It's not just a story. This is an account.
This is
history.
This is a biblical account. And one of the things that's very striking about the Christmas story is the fact that we are given very scant information on it. It only appears in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke. Mark and John have literally nothing about the Nativity. But what we're given is very sublime, but it is very concise, not very many details. And one of the other things... we want to say, though, is the fact that probably the brevity of this Christmas story is one that actually lends more credibility to the truthfulness of the story, because typically human beings with a story this old have a tendency to want to embellish and furnish details that aren't there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the very fact that what we have is very concise and short adds to its credibility. One of the other things I think Matthew and I both want to say is today we're not here to demythologize or debunk the Christmas story in any way. Essentially, what we have is a fairly accurate rendering, and the story that we all know, it may not be completely in line with what we've been told, but it works, and it's good.
Well, the fact is, you know, there's a little bit of fuzziness on some of the details, and we'll look at that just for fun. But the basic story of the Nativity that you know about, that's basically factual. And besides, we're trying to sympathize with your poor pastor, who even now, as he's rushing to the mall and trying to get all his Christmas shopping
and have quality family time,
is racking his mind trying to think of something new to say in his sermon for Christmas. So we don't want to step on anybody's toes there. We're not going to tackle any major theological issues. We'll talk about some of the details that conflict and describe what we do know about the Holy Family, some of the background, and just basically paint a picture that hopefully is not as this full for everyone.
All right.
But we're looking forward to it.
Well, then, I didn't even know there were any conflicts to be or fuzzy areas.
Well, you know, when we talk about a fuzzy area, you know, we're talking about when did the wise men come? Was Jesus born in a cave or a stable?
Haley's Comet we saw?
You know, there's all sorts of stuff, and we'll bring that up during the show.
You know what?
Show.
We know that he was born in 4 B.C. because we know that's when Quirinius was governor of Syria and all that, and we've got the records. And so the monk who started, you know, dating time, was it back in the 6th or 7th century, something like that?
His name was Dionysius, and he was appointed by the Pope. It was 525 A.D. Dionysius was appointed by the Pope to come up with a uniform calendar by which the church in the West could date everything and have all their festivals in a uniform way.
Hey.
And Dionysius, he did a bunch of research because time in that part of the world and at that time, calendars were reckoned from the founding of Rome. So you didn't have... B.C. or A.D. or anything. It was A.U.C., which stood for the Latin for the founding of Rome. And he did all this research and found, to the best of his knowledge, that Jesus was born in 754 AUC in Roman time. And so he affixed that as...
Zero.
No, as 1 AD.
He started at 1?
He started at 1 AD, and that went on for some time. And then what happened was later on they found different information about when Herod actually died, and Herod had to be alive at the time of Christ. And so rather than change everything around, they moved the date to B.C., a few years. So somewhere between anywhere from 6 to 1 B.C. And, of course, the implication, I think, for all of us in this case is the fact that it is a lot later than we think.
Let that be a lesson to you.
It is a lot later than we think, okay?
It is. It's by a few years later than we really think. So
whatever year you're going to assign this to, and 4 B.C. is a good time. Let's go back in time, set the dials on the Wayback Machine here. Now, we're looking at Galilee at the time of Christ's birth. Now, this is an incredibly agriculturally rich area. The ground is just beautifully fertile, a lot of loam, a lot of drainage, runoff, as opposed to the more lunar landscapes of the Judean wilderness, some of the Transjordan areas. Galilee was gorgeous, and as a result, very productive. A lot of agriculture, a lot of food. Josephus says that each of the 200 villages, Josephus, the old Jewish historian, says each of the 200 villages in Galilee had in excess of 15,000 people apiece. Well, okay, that's a little overboard. Josephus was known for that. But basically what we can count on is the fact that it was a very crowded place. It was very prosperous, healthy. Nobody was starving. It was primarily Jewish. It was maybe 60-70% Jewish. A lot of Gentiles there in Galilee. And they were surrounded by the Hellenistic influences over on the coast, down in Scythopolis, Bet-Shean, and across the Jordan River in Decapolis. So they were surrounded by Greek influences, but they held on to their Jewish identity. So as Christ is born here, and we look at Mary and Joseph growing up in Nazareth, they're in a pretty healthy spiritual environment. So we have basically...
Nazareth being off up to the northwest of the Sea of Galilee.
Actually, almost dead west
of
the Sea of Galilee by about 20 miles. And it's a beautiful area. It's just gorgeous. But Nazareth itself is actually very small. It's only got the one well, so maybe 400 or 500 people, and which was something we'll refer to later, is just over the ridge by a couple miles is a huge metropolis called Sepphoris, which is one of the largest cities in Galilee. We didn't even really know very much about it until recently. We discovered the ruins. And around the time of Christ's birth, it's destroyed by an earthquake, and we're going to talk about that a little bit too. But that was like a seat of government, military, housing, Greek culture. So as he's growing up, Jesus is being exposed to a huge cross-section of this.
Probably a Roman garrison there.
Oh, very much. And this is where he undoubtedly learned to speak three languages. There was very little about Greek culture he was unfamiliar with. But let's look at Mary and Joseph. As a matter of fact, we toyed with the idea of calling this program Mary and Joseph, or Joseph and Mary, we should call it Tecton and Theotokos.
Mercy, turbulence.
Now let's look at tecton, by golly, and that really is simply the Greek word for craftsman, which is what we translate as carpenter in our Bible. So when you read Joseph as a carpenter, he's really a tecton or a craftsman. And contemporary Jewish historians say what that was, it's not just a carpenter. It's not just a woodworker. It's more like what we are familiar with as a millwright or a shipwright. It's a guy that can do anything. He is a stone dresser. He is a metal worker. The best of them became woodworkers because wood was very scarce. You didn't trust wood to somebody that didn't know what he was doing.
They weren't burning 2x4s.
No,
for fires at construction sites in Galilee.
No, wood was solid gold there. As a matter of fact, what is that great scene in the Passion of Christ with the...
Oh, I love that, where Jesus is building the table, and Mary comes out and looks at it and says, "What's this? What's a table? Well, how do you use it?" "Sit in chairs." "Ah, it'll never catch on." What a great scene.
Oh, that was a good scene. And maybe it wasn't that bad, but wood was not nearly as widespread in its uses as we're familiar with it. So Joseph, as we're seeing him when he becomes betrothed to Mary, he is he's a young craftsman. He's probably in his mid-20s. He's spent enough time, 10 years in his craft, so that he is known as a craftsman, as a tecton, a carpenter. He is well thought of in the community. It's very probable that he was the chief tecton of Nazareth. And when he's approached by the rabbi, to consider marrying Mary, who is 12 to 13 years old, 14 maybe. Now, that does sound a little shocking to us that we're marrying girls off at that age, but you have to remember that women died at the age of 30, primarily.
Average life expectancy for a woman in the Roman Empire was roughly 31, 32.
Amazing.
We forget, living in a highly technological society, we have good nutrition, good medical care. We forget how many emergencies there are related with childbirth. And an average woman could expect to, if you lived to be 40, you were a pretty old maid. And so if you think about that, when you talk about somebody being 13 or 14, you're talking about somebody in midlife at that particular point in history. And, of course, another thing, you know, when we think today, we go, man, that's odd, kind of almost hillbilly-like, you know, to have a child bride like that. But we don't raise our girls to be women at that age. Childhood is extended well into the 20s by our culture, where their culture, womanhood, is right there, post-puberty. Mm-hmm. You're a woman, and you're raised to be a woman, and responsibilities and all the things of a house. You're trained in that. And so this is not really an odd thing. Mary was definitely of marriageable age but Joseph, we believe, and most people believe, was older than Mary. But how much older, that widely varies. There's even a tradition that Joseph was 90 years old when he married Mary, and there's a bunch of bizarre stories that go with that.
Oh, we could touch on that. You know that in the early church, as they were considering, you know, how best, what is Mary's role, how should we remember her, it became there was a lot of pressure on some of the church fathers to go with the flow and kind of endorse the doctrine of Mary's perpetual virginity. And I mean, that still has a lot of followers today. Although, truthfully, looking at the scripture, once you've had a baby, it's hard to really, you know, be technically a virgin. And the fact of Jesus's brothers and even sisters, it's very likely, and even St. Augustine went with this. He didn't think that she was perpetually a virgin. He thought, oh no, she was a wife and a mother. And although she conceived in virginity, the Lord, by the time Jesus was born, she went on to be just a regular mom. And she was tough too, boy. The fact that she lived another 30, 40 years was a testament to her toughness, and just the beauty of her character. A humble Jewish maiden. And when the Lord called, by golly, she said, okay. She was probably scared to death and probably didn't have any understanding of what she was getting into, but she was ready to go if the Lord called. Her Magnificat was, Tom Cahill, the contemporary historian, calls Mary's poem of praise to the Lord. He says it's the most muscular celebration of poetry in all of ancient literature. And which is a beautiful way to describe that. Whether or not she got help, I don't know with that, but it sure is a beautiful,
a well-done thing. And Joseph and Mary, you know, they're kind of underestimated, I think, as far as examples for us. But they are truly both examples of obedience and discipleship to the Lord, and just the offering of oneself and being diligent to follow what the Lord revealed to them, and wonderful examples. Well, that brings us to the Christmas story, the story that we all know and the events that happened around Jesus' birth. One of the questions is, did it really happen December 25th? And there's certainly no reason that it couldn't have happened in the middle of winter, and there's no reason it couldn't have happened on December 25th. Sacrificial lambs were kept outside, even in the winters in Bethlehem. Also, the date of December 25th was recognized very, very early in the history of the church. A lot of people think that was something that happened after Constantine and the making of Christianity a state religion, when in fact, that date goes all the way back to Tertullian, he was a very, very well-known and popular teacher, 2nd century A.D., and Tertullian claimed that there was a written birth record in Rome of Jesus' birth, that he was born December 25th.
I didn't know
about that.
And so this tradition goes very, very, very far back. Now, where that birth record is. Who knows? And
maybe
Tertullian heard
of,
Tertullian was a theologian and a church leader. He was not a historian and a record keeper. But it just goes to show you that the December 25th day does go way, way, way back. Of course, what is troubling with this view, though, is the fact that if it follows that Jesus is born on December 25th, then what that means is, and remember John the Baptist, principal character in this story, who's 6 months born ahead of Jesus, that means that the Annunciation, the conception of John the Baptist, the birth of John the Baptist, and the birth of Jesus Christ would all correspond with the four seasons, which sounds awfully a lot like it's a convenient way of arranging the